let me tell you about Ahab, the Arab, the sheikh of the burning sand. He had emeralds and rubies just a-dripping off of him, and a ring on every finger of his hand. He wore a big old turban wrapped around his head and a scimitar by his side. And every evening about midnight, he'd jump on his camel named Clyde and ride silently through the night to the Sultan's tent, where he would secretly meet up with Fatima of the Seven Veils, the swingin'est number one dancer in the Sultan's whole harem. 'Cause like him and her had a thing going, you know, and they'd been carrying on for some time now behind the Sultan's back. And you could hear him talk to his camel as he rode out across the dunes. His voice would cut through the still night desert air, and he'd say, oh, yeah, 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 oh, yeah, 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 which is Aramaic for whoa, babies. And Clyde say, well, he brought his camel to a screeching halt in the rear of Fatima's tent. Jumped off Clyde, snuck around the corner and into the tent he went. There he saw Fatima laying on a zebra skin rug, with rings on her fingers and bells on her toes and a bone in her nose, ho, ho. There she was, friends and neighbors laying there in all her radiant beauty, eating on a raisin and a grape and an apricot and a pomegranate, a bowl of chitterlings, two bananas, three Hershey bars, and sipping on an ROC Coca, listening to her transistor, watching the Grand Ole Opry, and reading Mad Magazine while she sung, does your chewing gum lose its flavor? And Ahab walk up to her and he say, oh yeah, 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 oh 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 yeah, which is Aramaic for let's twist again like we did last summer, babies. And she say, crazy baby. All of a sudden the Sultan walked in. Ahab knew that this was the end. Him and Fatima was caught by surprise, and the Sultan had fire flashing out of his eyes. Well, the Sultan charged at Ahab, intending to make a dent in his head, but he fled with Fatima, and out of the tent they went. They jumped on Clyde and started to ride, cutting out across the sand, with the Sultan's whole army in hot pursuit, on and on they ran. Well, to make a long story short, they got away, 'cause there weren't no animal alive what could keep up with Clyde once he got started, 'cause he would have swift his steed on the old desert babies. And they made it across the border where he had hopped all his rubies and emeralds, and they bought him a swanging little split-level pad and lived happy ever after. Yeah, and that's the story about Ahab, the Arab, the sheikh of the burning sand.
Here's one more item for you, the last in our civics book, rights. Boy, everyone in this country's always running around yammering about their fucking rights. I have a right, you have no right, we have a right, they don't have a right. Folks, I hate to spoil your fun, but there's no such thing as rights, okay? They're imaginary. We made them up, like the boogeyman. The three little pigs, Pinocchio, Mother Goose, shit like that. Rights are an idea, they're just imaginary. They're a cute idea, cute, but that's all, cute and fictional. But if you think you do have rights, let me ask you this. Where do they come from? People say, well, they come from God. They're God-given rights. Oh, fuck, here we go again. Here we go again. The God excuse, the last refuge of a man with no answers and no argument, it came from God. Anything we can't describe must have come from God. Personally, folks, I believe that if your rights came from God, he would have given you the right to some food every day, and he would have given you the right to a roof over your head. God would have been looking out for you. God would have been looking out for you. You know that? He wouldn't have been worried about making sure you have a gun so you could get drunk on Sunday night and kill your girlfriend's parents. But let's say it's true. Let's say God gave us these rights. Why would he give us a certain number of rights? The Bill of Rights in this country has 10 stipulations, okay? 10 rights. And apparently God was doing sloppy work that week because we've had to amend the Bill of Rights an additional 17 times. So God forgot a couple of things, like slavery. Just fucking slipped his mind. But let's say God gave us the original 10. He gave the British 13. The British Bill of Rights has 13 stipulations. The Germans have 29. The Belgians have 25. The Swedish have only 6. And some people in the world have no rights at all. What kind of a fucking goddamn God-given deal is that? No rights at all? Why would God give different people in different countries different numbers of different rights? Boredom? Amusement? Bad arithmetic? Do we find out at long last, after all this time, that God is weak in math skills? Doesn't sound like divine planning to me. Sounds more like human planning. Sounds more like one group trying to control another group. In other words, business as usual in America. Now, if you think you do have rights, one last assignment for you. Next time you're at the computer, get on the internet, go to Wikipedia. When you get to Wikipedia, in the search field for Wikipedia, I want you to type in Japanese Americans 1942, and you'll find out all about your precious fucking rights, okay? All right. You know about it. You know about it. Yeah. In 1942, there were 110,000 Japanese American citizens in good standing, law-abiding people who were thrown into internment camps simply because their parents were born in the wrong country. That's all they did wrong. They had no right to a lawyer, no right to a fair trial, no right to a jury of their peers, no right to due process of any kind. The only right they had, right this way, into the internment camps. Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. And rights aren't rights if someone can take them away. They're privileges. That's all we've ever had in this country is a bill of temporary privileges. And if you read the news even badly, you know that every year the list gets shorter and shorter and shorter. You see how similar? Yeah. Sooner or later, the people in this country are going to realize the government does not give a fuck about them. Government doesn't care about you or your children or your rights or your welfare or your safety. It simply doesn't give a fuck about you. It's interested in its own power. That's the only thing. Keeping it and expanding it wherever possible. Personally, when it comes to rights, I think one of two things is true. I think either we have unlimited rights or we have no rights at all. Personally, I lean toward unlimited rights. I feel, for instance, I have the right to do anything I please. But if I do something you don't like, I think you have the right to kill me. So where are you going to find a fairer fucking deal than that? So the next time some asshole says, gee, I have a right to my opinion, you say, oh yeah, well, I have a right to my opinion, and my opinion is you have no right to your opinion. Then shoot the fuck and walk away. Thank you.
Well, I know I play that quite a bit, but I love it. I love that stuff. Hey, here's Terrible Tommy, and it's Saturn's Day. It's the April. Wait a minute. It's August the 1st, 2015, and we got a full moon. It was beautiful. My gal and I were driving up to the lake last night, and this big, big moon hit us right in the face. Beautiful. And we had a blue moon, too. How about that? I guess that only happens about once every 30 years. Is that it? I don't know. 30 months or something like that. Hey, my good buddy Roddy Piper died. Remember him? He was a champion wrestler. Used to wear his Scottish skirt into the ring. But the thing I liked about Roddy Piper was the fact that he was the star of the film They Live. And if you're not familiar with the movie They Live, you better get it and watch it, because that's a movie where these beings from somewhere else are taking over the earth, and they're able to make you look at them like they're real people. But if you wear certain glasses that they were able to develop, you can see they're monsters. And Roddy Piper was in that film. It sounds sort of hokey, but it was a very good film. They Live. He did some other films, too. Not too many, but he did some. And he did like most people would like to do. He died in his sleep in his own bed. But he was only about 62. Well, I'm going to play for you today some stuff from another big-time wrestler. He's on Russia Today now. You know, he was the governor of Wisconsin, I believe it was. Yes, that's the Jesse Ventura show, and it's a new show on Russia Today, Russian TV. So anyhow, I'm going to play some stuff that sounded pretty good to me.
For our first segment, we're going to give you issues Hillary Clinton and President Obama can't seem to make their minds up about. Brigida, it's time to hear all about the Democratic flip-flop.
As stated by the Washington Post, the Obama years were a time of dramatic shifts in public opinion on a number of issues. Americans have fluctuated on how they feel about marriage, national security, abortion, education, marijuana, crime, and even Confederate flags. The things that were acceptable a decade or even a few months ago are no longer acceptable anymore. As a result, politicians have had to adapt to the changing political landscape. But the problem is, adaptation can look a whole lot like hypocrisy. Let's take Hillary Clinton and President Barack Obama, for example. Both have flip-flopped over the years on two major issues, immigration and same-sex marriage. During Hillary's third campaign event, while speaking at Rancho High School in Las Vegas this year, she said, quote, "I will fight for comprehensive immigration reform and a path to citizenship. I will fight to stop partisan attacks on the executive action that would put dreamers with us today at risk of deportation. And if Congress refuses to act as president, I would do everything under the law to go even further." However, in 2003, during a WABC radio interview on the John Gambling Show, she said the opposite, stating, quote, "I am, you know, adamantly against illegal immigrants. We've got to do more at our borders, and people have to stop employing illegal immigrants." Governor, do you think flip-flopping will hurt Hillary's chances of becoming the next president? Or will people buy what she's selling at the moment?
No, I don't think it'll hurt her at all, because the thing you got to remember about the American people, generally, and I'm giving them the extreme benefit of the doubt here, generally the American people don't have a memory over a decade. Now, whether they don't remember it or they don't want to remember it, I'm not quite sure. But no, I don't think that's going to bother Hillary, because it was back in the old past. So you got to remember, these politicians go which way the wind blows. If a decade ago the wind is out of the west, that's where they're at. If a decade later the wind's out of the east, they flip-flop and go that way. Now, don't get me wrong, sometimes flip-flopping's okay. If you can prove that you became more educated and you understand the problem more, not simply because it's the popular thing to do.
Moving on to President Obama, he has claimed many times in the past that he had no power to ignore or create his own immigration laws. For example, in 2010, he said, "Comprehensive reform, that's how we're going to solve this problem. Anybody who tells you it's going to be easy or that I can wave a magic wand and make it happen hasn't been paying attention to how this town works." But then in 2012, Obama issued an executive order that halted deportations of young illegal immigrants. As long as these immigrants were under the age of 30, had moved to America before they were 16 years old, lived in the country for at least 5 years, and met certain criteria, they were eligible for deferred action on deportation. So basically, the president used his authority to enact the policy, even though he claimed previously that he had no authority to do so. Governor, do you think Hillary and Obama have truly evolved on their beliefs on immigration, or are they simply pandering to voters?
He wants us to believe in 2 years he finally figured out that he could do it as the president, when 2 years prior he didn't have a clue he could do those things. That's the only thing I can attribute it to. Or it was politics at its as usual worst, where he wanted to put the heat on the Congress to do it so that he could win politically, as opposed to doing it himself, where he ran the risk to lose politically.
As for the other issue both Hillary and Obama have flip-flopped on, same-sex marriage, Gallup polls show that since becoming an issue in 1996, public support has greatly increased. This year's poll shows 60% of Americans are in favor of same-sex marriage. 2 decades ago, only 27% of Americans were in support. Back in 2000, when Hillary was running for Senate in New York, she said, quote, marriage has got historic religious and moral content that goes back to the beginning of time. And I think a marriage, as a marriage has always been, is between a man and a woman. But this year, just before the Supreme Court legalized gay marriage, Hillary was singing a different tune. She posted a letter on her website asking people to sign their names and join her in support of the issue. The letter says, quote, LGBT couples should not have to make a case for their relationship. Every family deserves to be recognized under the law and treated equally in our society, not just in some states, but in every state.
Well, again, did she truly see the light and change her opinion on facts? Or was it just political advantage to do so, and again, which way the wind was blowing? That's what you got to try to determine with these people when they make these massive changes a decade later from what they were saying a decade earlier. Is it legit or isn't it legit? And only that person that says it really knows for sure if they really, or did they truly have a change of heart? We won't know. But anyway... I tend to be a little bit on the side of they flip-flop for themselves, not for the issues.
Obama, who was originally pro-same-sex marriage, flip-flopped once before ending up back in favor of it again. While running in 1996 for Illinois State Senate, Obama filled out a written questionnaire in which he wrote, I favor legalizing same-sex marriages and would fight efforts to prohibit such marriages. Then, 2 years later, in 1998, he filled out another questionnaire stating, quote, I am a fierce supporter of domestic partnership and civil union laws. I am not a supporter of gay marriage, as it has been thrown about primarily just as a strategic issue. Finally, this year, after the Supreme Court ruling, he stated, in my second inaugural address, I said that if we were truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. It's gratifying to see that principle enshrined into law by this decision.
Because he's got one part telling him it's wrong, 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 and the Bible saying it's wrong, 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 and his body's telling him the opposite. It's right, right, right. Don't get me wrong. Changing your position, if you become more educated and know more about it and realize that you were premature in your decision earlier, there's nothing wrong with that. It shows that you have, that you got the courage and the guts to change your position. So you can change your position, but you change it, you got to be sincere about it and sincere to yourself and not do it to save your political career. That isn't the reason you change your position. It looks like flip-flopping might be here to stay. Keep the conversation going online by going to aura.tv/off-the-grid. Sit tight, because my chat with Max Blumenthal on Israel's invasion of Gaza is coming up right now. Welcome, Max Blumenthal, to Off the Grid. First of all, you know, Max, one thing kind of puzzles me today. How come when they have wars now, they have to give them these catchy little names and stuff?
Right. I mean, Israel is the master of catchy little names for wars. They're not just catchy, they're friendly names like Operation Summer Rain, Operation Pillar of Cloud. It sounds like Care Bears are dropping candy on the Gaza Strip. This time the war was called Operation Protective Edge. It has a defensive quality to the title of the war, when in fact Israel was the aggressor. It violated the ceasefire that led to the war. As you mentioned in the outset, over 2,200 people were killed, including over 500 children. According to the Associated Press, near 850 people were killed by Israeli precision-guided missiles at home at night. 89 families were wiped from the civil registry in the Gaza Strip, meaning that these families lost most or all members in Israeli airstrikes. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem found that 25% of Palestinian casualties in the Gaza Strip during this 51-day war were people killed at home, mostly at night, while they were asleep. So in many ways, it wasn't a war. It was a massacre or a slaughter And it really belies the idea that Israel was defending its own security.
Max, if you could briefly give us a rundown on how this war got started, beginning with the three Israeli teens who were abducted and killed. Was that the catalyst that started the war?
Well, as I explain in my book, The 51-Day War, this war didn't start in the Gaza Strip. It started far from the Gaza Strip in the Israeli-occupied West Bank when three Jewish Israeli teens were kidnapped by two men who were identified later by the Israeli police as a rogue Hamas cell, meaning they were not taking orders from Hamas. The political leadership of Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip, did not want this kidnapping. And these two rogue figures were apparently trying to kidnap the teens to exchange for the hundreds of Palestinian prisoners that the Israeli government refused to release under U.S. demands. They were immediately killed because one of the teens attempted to call the Israeli police. The call was recorded. The police heard gunshots. They heard celebratory singing by the killers. And they knew the teens were dead, not only for that reason, but because the car in which the teens were kidnapped in was found burned. There were bullets and DNA and blood found in the car. The teens, in fact, were buried in a shallow grave on the property of one of the killers' homes. And so for 2 weeks, Netanyahu knew that the teens were dead. The Israeli government knew the teens were dead. And instead of telling the Israeli public, they put the Israeli media under a gag order. So no one was allowed to report that the teens were dead. They couldn't even report on the details of the investigation. So for all the Israeli public knew, the teens were still out there. They were missing. And the Israeli military was rampaging through the West Bank. Under the pretext of a rescue operation, they were arresting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Palestinian politicians, Palestinian students, and anyone remotely affiliated with Hamas. On July 7th, after splinter factions in the Gaza Strip fire rockets into Israel, the Israeli military attacks Hamas installations. Hamas had not yet attacked, or counterattacked, as it were. And so this leads to the first Hamas counterattack. The following day, Operation Protective Edge begins. So what I outline in my book, The 51-Day War, was how this war was kind of avoidable, but it began with a political deception by Netanyahu, who had many reasons for this deception, one of which was to shatter the Palestinian Unity government. There was a government, for one of the first times in years, that brought together figures from Fatah, which controls the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And by creating this chaos and arresting Hamas figures in the West Bank, and you dismantle this unity government, you divide the Palestinian government, and you create a pretext for a war. And in Israel, war has kind of become a way of life that's ignited the weapons industry, and which is sort of part of its strategy for handling the Gaza Strip. So all of it's laid out in my book, and my account has been confirmed by even pro-Israel publications like the Jewish Daily Forward. It's something that pro-Israel advocates don't really want to talk about at this point.
My discussion with Max Blumenthal continues right after the break. These are orchestrated in the deceit sometimes that go into making them happen. Max,
yeah.
Let's discuss the militant groups in Palestine for a moment, like Hamas and Fatah. However you say that, so our viewers can understand the difference between these groups and the civilians in Gaza who suffered most from this attack. Can you talk about that? Because people need to understand, when wars like this happen, civilians, people not even involved, are always the biggest casualties, aren't they?
Right. The Palestinian Authority, which is controlled by Fatah, is sort of a shadow entity, it's a really hollow entity that is a native occupation subcontractor. Hamas in the West Bank, which controls the Gaza Strip, is an Islamist organization. It was inspired by the Muslim Brotherhood. It's considered a terrorist organization by the United States, even though it has no ambition to attack any targets internationally. And just like Fatah, has traditionally resisted the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And it governs in the Gaza Strip, so it's basically a political entity. And Hamas has not given up its traditional charter of resisting the occupation, including with weapons. So its military wing, which is called the Al-Qassam Brigades, has engaged the Israeli military in combat. We need to look at the statistics of casualties in this war to understand how the war was fought. Now, I laid out at the beginning of this interview the casualty counts of Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip. Most of those who were killed were civilians, and over 500 were children. Many people, nearly half of the people who were killed at home at night, so they were completely uninvolved in combat. There were about 75 Israeli citizens who were killed in this 51-day war. 75. And of that 75, about 69 were combat soldiers. In other words, they were soldiers who were invading and occupying the Gaza Strip, who were killed by the Al-Qassam Brigades and other armed factions in the Gaza Strip that weren't affiliated in any way with Hamas. Just basically young men coming out to defend their homes in territory that was theirs, which the Israelis occupy. It's pretty clear from the statistics, just from the facts of who was killed, that the Al-Qassam Brigades and the armed factions in the Gaza Strip were attacking military targets, while the Israeli military was aiming to attack civilians. And actually, the Israeli military has a stated doctrine in which it declares that it will attack civilians in order to attempt to turn them against their leadership. It's called the Dahiya Doctrine. And Israel will seek to attack the civilians deliberately in order to turn them against the political factions that they support. That's the open strategy for the Gaza Strip, and it's why we see increasing violence, increasing brutality towards the civilian population with each one of these conflicts or assaults on the Gaza Strip.
Reports show that Israel currently receives $3 billion per year in U.S. military aid and has asked recently for more, even more money. What do you think about the relationship between the United States and Israel?
Well, this is an amazing development. I mean, in order to basically bribe Israel after the U.S. signs a deal which was in its national interest with Iran around Iran's nuclear program to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, it has to bribe the state of Israel by increasing its annual aid to $4.5 billion, provide Israel with state-of-the-art weapons, and provide it with all the tools it needs to increase the casualty count the next time it attacks the Gaza Strip, basically in order to mollify it so it doesn't attack Iran unilaterally. It doesn't seem like a rational strategy, does it? And it's really not. Israel is basically a problem. It's not a strategic asset. It's a huge liability. And the fact that the U.S. needs to bribe Israel in order to sign a deal that's in its national interest is proof of that. That's why we have such a massive pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. that will drag my or your reputation through the mud just for talking about these facts. Just like guns and tobacco, Israel kills a lot of people. It's a pretty toxic product, and so it requires a really vicious lobby that's operating in Washington that seeks to prevent this discussion while it's lobbying for more and more arms to perpetuate an occupation that's been going on for just about 50 years and to maintain a bloody status quo. If Americans had more access to these facts, I think they would turn against this lobby much more quickly. But when I get out there in the country, Jesse, and you've been out there too, you kind of sense that Americans do kind of get it. I've just been out on book tour. Something's happening out there. My talks are packed. People are incredibly upset about U.S. aid to Israel, U.S. support for these assaults on a helpless, defenseless civilian population. And they're supporting a movement called the BDS movement, which stands for Boycott, Divest, and Sanction. And they're aiming to put grassroots pressure on their government and on the state of Israel to change the status quo. I think we're seeing that for the first time. And it's actually a really exciting time in which people aren't depending on politicians anymore who are bought off by the pro-Israel lobby.
Thanks to Max for that eye-opening conversation. Now,
do you realize there's over 5 million Puerto Ricans living in the United States and more coming all the time. There's only 3 million Puerto Ricans living in Puerto Rico. To give you an idea how the gates are open, U.S. State Department just opens the doors and let them all come in. And yet, the population, and especially the white population, are so stupid as to think they're doing a wonderful thing by just letting the doors stand wide open, and here they come. We're going to have to pay for it as time goes on. Actually, we're paying for it now. All these people who get older, they all collect Social Security, climb on the Social Security rolls, welfare rolls, and everything else. Over 5 million Puerto Ricans.
Extreme historians say there was a Jesus, so that must settle it. There must have been a Jesus. It's also the case that many atheists, though convinced that there's no God, will also say, well, I think there was a Jesus. So I want to take a few minutes to convince you that mainstream historians, and atheists possibly influenced by them, are actually wrong. Now let's first of all clarify just who it is we are talking about. We are not speaking of any old character of the first century Galilee who had the name Jesus. There were lots of those, literally thousands, because Yeshua or Yehoshua was one of the most common Jewish names of the time. We are speaking of a character who was supposedly the source and inspiration for the fantastical tales that fill the pages of the New Testament. Yes, I am allowing for the fact that embellishment and exaggeration could have been applied to an original, simple, and genuine tale, that the man behind the legend may have been a rather ordinary character. But of course, it could not have been too ordinary, or he would not have stood out from the thousands of others who shared his name. Let me introduce you to one such figure, one favoured by mainstream historians such as Bar Ehrman and others. For them, the real Jesus was a prophet in the style of earlier Jewish prophets, who had a following for his particular brand of end-time doom and gloom. Because he was unexpectedly executed, his despairing followers reinvented him as a risen Messiah or Christ. All else in the New Testament is embellishment and invention. So here we have a rationalized, acceptable Jesus, who doesn't suspend the laws of the universe. But he is only one of hundreds of rationalized Jesuses. You may have a favorite of your own, a radical rabbi, a Jewish nationalist, a healer, a teacher, you name it. They are all equally valid and all equally speculative, floating free of any factual foundation. Now, why do I say these various alternative Jesuses are speculations? Because not one of them is based on hard, verifiable evidence from non-biblical sources. Any one of them is possibly true, but is any one of them even probably true? Each is derived from a selective reading of the gospel stories. Each is built up from certain passages, discounting all the rest as pious fabrication. That's why the so-called mainstream historians cut the ground from beneath each other. What is the pious fabrication to one is the residual element of a genuine historical episode to another. Yet not one part of the story is immune from being pious fiction to some and having the ring of truth to others. But there is an alternative to this free-for-all join-the-dots-and-make-your-own-Jesus approach, and that is to recognize that these speculations are no better than seeing the signs of the zodiac in the night sky. In reality, there is no figure there, whether a sign of the zodiac or a Jesus of Nazareth. Now, Christianity makes a claim that a truly fabulous character started the movement with his teachings and miracles, climaxing in his resurrection appearances after death. But can rational minds really claim that some minor character, below the visible event horizon of history, was either necessary or useful to a story that is acknowledged to be, in all salient aspects, fabricated from religious literature? The simplest, parsimonious explanation is that no human Jesus ever existed. Now, although historians like Bar Ehrman think that it required the memory of a dead holy man to get the first Christians dreaming up a resurrected Messiah, in truth, merely the idea of a dead holy man works just as well. And we can be absolutely certain it was just the idea of a dead holy man, because the one thing we can say about the Gospels is that they were not written by simple, illiterate, Aramaic-speaking fishermen and peasants who knew Jesus, but were written decades later by literate, educated writers who wrote in Greek and were, incidentally, rather hazy about the Jewish landscape. We are not dealing with eyewitnesses. The gospel writers had either to be told the story or had to read their inspiration elsewhere. And what could they have read in the holy books of the Jews, translated into Greek centuries earlier? They would have read of healing and resurrection miracles, tales of food multiplication, of divine judgments, of wise prophets in special communication with God, who wander about making pleasing and sometimes enigmatic wisdom statements. They would have read of a suffering servant who takes on the sins of the world, of babies born by divine intervention. In other words, they would have read all the core elements in order to write an inspiring story of a Jewish saviour God-man, a Jesus Christ. All good stuff, of course, for a religious fable. But it isn't history. It isn't true. It's more astounding rubbish.
The idea that Jesus never existed, a thesis simply ignored in the 20th century by the vested interests of religion and biblical scholarship, has argued its way back onto the agenda. It has compelled the mandarins of orthodoxy to issue angry rebuttals, an insistent mantra of, "But of course Jesus existed." Yet whisper-thin defences of an historical Jesus do not cut it in the internet-enabled world. Increasing numbers of web-savvy inquirers are asking, what real evidence is there for an historical Jesus? And they are not convinced by the replies. And established academics don't like that one little bit. With the supernatural elements removed from the gospel story, what then is left of a man called Jesus to remember decades after his death? Why would he be remembered at all when numerous other Jesuses were forgotten? The proponents of an historical Jesus defend the idea that a single man became the focus about which a stupendous legend grew. Yet does a mountain of artifice really need a dead non-entity to get it going? Is it really so difficult to grasp that Hellenized Jews, finally cast adrift from a devastated temple Judaism, should concoct precisely that syncretism of man and God which merged Jewish notions of historical determinism and its anticipated Messiah with the mores of polytheism? In the 21st century, the non-existence of Jesus has passed from the obsession of a lunatic fringe that could be contemptuously ignored to a global battle for truth, characterized as much by its churlish language and speed of development as by argument and counter-argument. The result is that a paradigm shift is in progress. So what has really happened in recent decades? For the whole of the 20th century, historicists controlled the universities and main publishing houses,
yet they failed to discover any new evidence for Jesus in the Levant. Instead, we saw two important developments. The first was the ascendancy of the Christian right in the United States and a concomitant domination of New Testament studies by well-funded fundamentalism. The effect of this was to poison the well from which even secular scholars still draw. These historicists, heirs to a tradition that had rejected the divinity of Jesus, had become the new apologists, recycling the sophistry of fundamentalist arguments simply shorn of their supernatural elements. In fact, many of them cling to a sentimental affection for the church they once knew and a Jesus they once loved. The second game-changing development has been the rapid development of the technology of communication. With the ubiquitousness of the internet and the rise of self-publishing, we have entered a new era. Once again, the control over information by a cartel has been broken. Jesus deniers, for the first time in history, are able to directly reach a global audience. The mythicists have a voice and are being heard in ever larger numbers. In this new, globalized debate, old school academics are appalled and angered by this threat to their calm and leisured study of religion, to their loss of a monopoly long exercised through the great university libraries, their PhD degrees, and their expensive professional journals. Hurriedly and in vain, they have attempted to dismiss the entire scholarship of mythicism with magisterial pronouncements, know-it-all pomposity, and visceral attacks on Jesus mythicists as clowns and idiots. Yet arrogance and pomposity wins few friends. The nagging questions remain. Why was Jesus notable if he did not draw multitudes from across the region? Why was he remembered decades later if he did not perform spectacular healings and miracles? Why is it that all the non-gospel sources that underpin the historical Jesus are hypothetical sources, oral traditions, Aramaic sources, Q, M, L, etc.? Why is the core historical episode of the gospel tradition, the story of Jesus' death on the cross, completely lacking in convincing historical detail, being rather a liturgical drama built up from the Psalms and prophetic texts? Now that's a quotation from today's Jesus myth denier, Joseph Hoffman, in his more skeptical days. Why did the followers of Jesus just start believing that he had been resurrected if the laws of the universe had not been suspended? Who precisely were the authors of the canonical Gospels? Is it not very curious that these supposed truthful compilers of history were unknown in time or place, even in the second century? For that matter, where is the compelling evidence that early Christian writers were referring to the same minor individual? If a real Jesus influenced the story in any way at all, how can we be so certain that only one such figure had that sort of nebulous and very tangential influence? Did it require a human component to fabricate the high priest Melchizedek, the archangel Michael, the son of man Enoch, the tribal autocrat Moses, the conquering hero Joshua, the miracle-working prophet Elijah? With such a cornucopia of templates to work from, what precisely did the mythmakers require from a mere dead man before they could get to work? The new apologetics is at its weakest at precisely those points where the old apologetics offers miracle and marvel to resolve difficulties. Someone like Bart Ehrman, a dangerous radical by traditional standards, by avoiding the logical conclusions to be drawn from his own work, risks becoming the Martin Luther of this internet-enabled reformation. Ehrman himself admits that for 30 years he had to think about the hymn in Philippians, an early pre-Pauline source which just happens to describe Christ Jesus as a dying, rising God. The original Luther was a good Catholic who, like Ehrman, wanted to get back to the original texts. But Luther also started something he couldn't stop, and the printing press did the rest. Given the exponential growth of the internet, in but a few years, the mythicist contention of the non-existence of Jesus, that it is all a fiction, will become the accepted and obvious truth.
You can be from the swamps of Africa, just crawled out from the last stage of evolution. If you can make it to the shores of North America, and maybe even Europe, and crawl into a goddamn church, they'll defend your right to the debt to live there. And they'll pay you for living there. These fucking people don't deserve to survive. They mentioned in this Klan thing, this book, Bernard Law, Monsignor Bernard Law. He was the one that was a big shot Catholic in Boston or something. It was involved in covering for child molesters.
$50,000 to kill a beautiful lion. The only way anyone should be allowed to hunt big game is with a knife and a spear. And you got to do it barefooted.
Kaiser Report, I'm Max Kaiser. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. Oh, yes, I do, Stacy.
Max, this is the beginning, actually, of something on the Kaiser Report. We're going to do a series of solutions to the world's problems. This episode is going to be a two-parter, by the way. I'm sitting with you for the whole show.
And
we're going
to talk about I'm feeling so fine.
And we're talking about a piece that Paul Mason wrote, and he wrote this after having spent a lot of time in Greece looking at the financial collapse there and
the Masaka Enema. I think this is what the piece is about.
And the reverberations around the world. So his headline reads, "The End of Capitalism Has Begun." Capitalism, it turns out, will not be abolished by forced march techniques. It will be abolished by creating something more dynamic that exists at first, almost unseen within the old system, but will break through, reshaping the economy around new values and behaviors. I call this post-capitalism. He says from his perch down in Greece, he sees the end of capitalism. It's already there. Many in the old system don't recognize it, but that we see it in parallel currencies, he says. We see it in parallel economic systems, and this is called post-capitalism, he says.
Well, I'm already doing this with George Galloway. And George Galloway is running for mayor, and it's post-socialism and post-capitalism. So George Galloway is traditionally a left-wing politician. I'm more right-wing, more fiscal conservative. But we're at the now post both of these failed systems. Both socialism has failed, capitalism has failed. So it's post-socialism as well, Paul Mason should understand. So the Galloway campaign, I'm the financial advisor. We brought in the mayor's chain, which is a blockchain technology, which is what Paul almost gets to the point of talking about blockchain. He falls short, but he almost gets the point. And this blockchain technology will be broadcast to every citizen of London. Every time the mayor makes a change to the budget, it's broadcast to 8 million Londoners. Everything's done transparently, in real time. We're already there. Paul Mason, welcome. Welcome to our world.
Okay, well, he's identifying the problem, and he is saying the solutions are up to you. The possibilities are there. And the reason why the possibilities are there is just because of outside forces, because of the march of time, because these things happen. And no matter whether or not you want it, things will change. And he says, for example, as with the end of feudalism, 500 years ago, capitalism's replacement by post-capitalism will be accelerated by external shocks and shaped by the emergence of a new kind of human being, and it has started. So he posits that, you know, the time of feudalism was all about obligations, your obligations to the lord upon whose land you were tilling, and then we moved into, partly because of the Black Plague, the Black Death, which killed a huge percentage of the population. There were fewer people to till the land, so they therefore had a market price for their value of their tilling the land. So then we moved into a time of capitalism, which was based on market prices. And now we're moving into a period where market prices no longer determine anything about our economy. and this is his post-capitalism. And I'll go over the reasons why he says we're in post-capitalism, but if you have anything to say to that end of feudalism turning into capitalism...
Yeah, I wouldn't say we're at the end of market pricing. I would add that we're in a post-Freudian economy where the ego is not centric as it had been during the capitalist period. So you're going to have the emergence of the universal id, to put that in Freudian terms, the networked economy, digital...
It's not post-Freudian. It's just post...
post-Freudian post-ego. In terms of the motivation for much of the psychological ailments of modern man are due to his sexual lust and ego gratification. If you remove that from the equation, you have a new set of parameters driving human beings. As you point out, we're entering into a new stage of the human development, or a post, what I would think would be a post-Freudian, egocentric, lustful, power aggregation centric world toward this networked economy where values are shifting. I've talked about this for many, many years. You have essentially the blooming everywhere simultaneously around the world with a new consciousness that places the values of the network above the individual. But that's, again, it's not socialism, because socialism as such has failed.
Well, okay, we're going to go over his 3 points of why post-capitalism is now possible, but I want to say about the values of humans. If, for example, Bitcoin, if that's a new system, you could see in the raw character of the human being, this sort of person with their values that attended the very first sort of conferences back in 2009, 2010. Those were different from the bankers now trying to apply the same old system to this. But that won't work. That'll fail. And so here we'll go back to his piece about post-capitalism. It is possible because the 3 major changes information technology has brought about in the past 25 years. First, it has reduced the need for work, blurred the edges between work and free time, and loosened the relationship between work and wages. The coming wave of automation, currently stalled because our social infrastructure cannot bear the consequences, will hugely diminish the amount of work needed, not just to subsist, but to provide a decent life for all. So we're going to actually talk about that in our next episode of Solutions. But what do you say about this, that it's reduced the need for work, information technology, and this has brought about the end of capitalism?
Well, work, in the sense that this word has been understood for millennia, has to do with overcoming gravity, and that this has favored a certain style of capitalism. And after the hunter-gatherer phase that ended 10, 12,000 years ago, those who could conquer gravity via the ability to leverage manpower through huge assembly line techniques and the Industrial Revolution, or those that could master gravity in terms of compressing information on a microprocessor at terabytes per chip, etc., have been able to usher in an enormous economies of scale that have obsolesced in many ways this idea of wealth that we and working as we've come to understand what that work means. So the nature of work will change. The underlying social order will not disappear. All social interaction is work on some level. All relationships are social interaction that require a conscious effort to succeed on all levels. All societies and groupings of individuals in towns or villages or tribes require social interaction that you could equate to work on some level. That's not going to go away. So I think he's a little, his analysis is a little thin, but I kind of get what
it's just a piece that, you know, 1,000 words in The Guardian. So
it's not bad.
But yeah. So we're going to actually go over that. In fact, it's not just work, it's income. The fact that all these robots will be creating products for people to buy, but there will be no jobs for them to create an income in which to buy them. So there is a point where the diminishing returns of having robots do all your work, but no humans to buy it. So we're going to move to the second point, what he says information technology has allowed for post-capitalism. Information is corroding the market's ability to form prices correctly. That is because markets are based on scarcity, while information is abundant. abundant. The system's defense mechanism is to form monopolies, the giant tech companies, on a scale not seen in the past 200 years. Yet they cannot last. By building business models and share valuations based on the capture and privatization of all socially produced information, such firms are constructing a fragile corporate edifice at odds with the most basic need of a humanity, which is to use ideas freely. So here we're going to throw this again to you, Max, because you have the solutions to this. You have actually worked on the virtual specialist technology, which dealt with creating prices for things as information and ideas and buzz and conversation and social interaction. So what do you say about this, that he's saying that that it's the fact that they're having to create monopolies around this information in order to create scarcity?
Yeah, well, we already see that with the copyright cartel, with the MPAA. We're willing to extrajudiciously send a SWAT team into New Zealand to arrest Kim.com, territory that they have no business being in. But the idea that economics is based on scarcity is a bit of a common mistake people make. Economics started at the agricultural revolution stage of human experience, which is based on oversupply. It's based on abundance. So when you suddenly have a huge abundance due to domestication of plants and animals, this thing called economics was born. How do you divide the abundance? This is a common mistake. It's not really driven by scarcity. But and this is again where if what we're entering now is the true nature of what's been there all along, is that the abundance of information. This is the same way as we've had the abundance of domesticated plants and animals. It's the same problem that we've always had. So this is where it requires an ethos to emerge from the digital soup that will organize humans in a way that precludes egocentric thinking and fosters a certain kind of group ethical aesthetic, which is going all the way back to paganism, Hinduism. Monotheism, I would say, is dead. Monotheism is dead. The three major monotheistic religions as such won't survive this next turning of humans' experience here on Earth.
Now, actually, there is a third point, but we'll go on to that in the second half because there's not much time left, but I do want to finish on this notion of copyright. Well, first of all, it used to cost quite a lot of money to create, like, Shakespeare's a copy of Shakespeare's productions. So to put it in print, it costs like thousands of dollars, the equivalent per copy. Like, it would cost a lot of money to create it. Now you create that one document, one song, you put it on the internet, and we could create a quadrillion copies at no additional cost, other than maybe a fraction of a penny of the energy produced to actually turn on your computer. So he does mention later in the article that during and right after the Second World War, economists viewed information simply as, quote, a public good. The U.S. government even decreed that no profit should be made out of patents, only from the production process itself. Then we began to understand intellectual property. In 1962, Kenneth Arrow, the guru of mainstream economics, said that in a free market economy, the purpose of inventing things is to create intellectual property rights. He noted, quote, precisely to the extent that it is successful, there is an underutilization of information. So you can see that, he said, that the opposite is what has created the revolutionary idea. So he's saying, if we restate Arrow's principles in reverse, its revolutionary implications are obvious. If a free market economy plus intellectual property leads to the, quote, underutilization of information, then an economy based on the full utilization of information cannot tolerate the free market or absolute intellectual property rights. The business models of all our modern digital giants are designed to prevent the abundance of information.
Well, that's patently wrong. My technology, the virtual specialist technology, patent number 5950176 in the U.S. Patent Office, clears a path toward having infinite ideas within a specialist system or market economy. We'll be back in the second half.
Are you an S&P 500 company?
We'll pick this up in the second half, Stacey. Thank you.
Well, that gets a little tedious, that information on the economy, but I thought that was quite interesting about the three Abrahamic religions being dying, and we're going to revert back into a paganist world ethos, which is good news to me. Well, I did an interview here some time ago that was with an obvious enemy. I did it in a noisy restaurant with, and she was using a recorder that was not working properly, so there were several errors in the article, but I decided to just send it out whole cloth. And I got an email this morning from a person who I've been on his show before, and he was upset because in the article she asked me, "Do you hate Jews and do you hate blacks?" And the simplest thing to do in situations like that is say yes. But that can't be true, because you got to understand that we are word-controlled humans. I've got a book on that we're going to go into one of these days. That these simplistic words are reduce the finest thoughts into simple, crude labels. Now, to me, hatred is something where you have dislike. You dislike a lot of things, most people do, all the way to the other end where it's extreme dislike, the kind that causes your guts to churn around every time you think of that person or that ideology or whatever it is. But I think it doesn't give the thought process or the feelings surrounding hate a chance. By simplifying, it's like love. I mean, you know, love is a very difficult thing to describe. And most of it is involved with lust. And then, if people are lucky, it can grow into love. Love, but even using the term love turns me off too, because these are things that really can't be described. And to use it in the way she was using it, I have to answer like a shotgun instead of a rifle, and I don't like that. And I don't mince words about it. I'm sure that I know that there are a large percentage of these Zionist types around that I hate, but it goes beyond hate. Hate is too simplistic. But there's people you meet on the street. You may meet up with a Jew that Rockwell would refer to them as a tame Jew, that are not directly interfering with my life, and in many cases not even trying to interfere with my life. So I'm not going to waste my buckshot, my lead, having an emotional breakdown every time I run into a Jew or a black. Because, well, with the blacks, you know of their inferiority, and you can't expect any more out of them than they can give. And so, obviously, there's a large percentage of them that are uncontrollable, and you would hate them. But it's more than the word. It's a feeling, it's a thought process converted to many times action that really describes this simplistic word of hate. I tried to explain that to this young man. I don't know whether he'll understand it or not, that to simplistically judge the fact that I said I don't hate Jews, I don't hate blacks, means that I don't have an overwhelming sense of a physical thing about him, and it's something that is far more worse than the word hate. While on the other hand, with a large number of these people, you could sit down and talk to them and meet them and pass the time of day. They're not really out conspiring to kill you, and that's what engenders this these physical feelings and mental thought processes that you can't even put it, you can't even put a term to it. But this young man, he said, "Oh, I'm getting all kinds of people saying they're just totally upset with you, and you said that stuff, and you're getting like David Duke and all that." And I don't know whether my explanation to the guy or anybody is going to be understood, but perhaps we'll get into this book called Word Controlled Humans. We are controlled by words and terms and sentences like that. And to describe the feeling you have towards a mortal enemy in a simple, four-letter word doesn't make it. It goes far beyond that. Far beyond that. And like I say, they tend to want to you to use a shotgun when describing your feelings about blacks or Jews or something like that instead of a rifle. Anyhow, in the end, I explained how I felt about things, and whether he understands what I'm talking about or not, I don't know. But I ended the email like I usually do. I said, if that's not a good enough explanation for these right-wingers, or whatever they call themselves, white nationalists today, they can kiss my white ass. Which I say quite a bit. Or like the song title says, I did it my way. Okay. Anyhow, any questions you may have along those lines, you can certainly communicate with me, but it's too bad a lot of these people are so intellectually shallow, and their thought processes are so shallow that everything is boiled down to such a simplistic situation and simplistic terms. I've often said that I think that maybe at one time we had the ability as a race to communicate by thoughts, because when you try to communicate with words, it's really lacking. You hear the word, you reduce it to a thought in your mind, and then you take that thought and reduce it again back into a word, and you communicate it to somebody else, which is the worst form. In fact, that's why there's a lot of times so many wars. People just don't understand each other because of the simplistic and crude words they use. So, anyhow, I'm going to close out here with a little bit. This was sort of a potpourri show today. I'm going to close out reading from the good book. The title of the book, of course, is Might is Right. Well, that's not quite correct, because I don't believe in right, really, or wrong. But you could say might is, I think, is more to the point. How is it that men of light and leading hardly ever call in question the manufactured moral codes under which our once vigorous northern race is slowly and surely eating out its heart in peaceful inaction and laborious dry rot? Standard moral principles are arbitrarily assumed by their orthodox apologists to be fixed and unalterable quality or quantity, and that to doubt the divine rightness of these principles is treason and sacrilege. You see, you notice how people who control the masses always want to boil it down into words. Maybe that's why people like Genghis Khan was so successful. I don't think he wrote much. He just got on his horse, put his battle axe on there, and took off. He communicated perfectly with those he opposed. Here I come, battle axe and all. Standard moral principles are arbitrarily assumed by their orthodox apologists to be fixed and unalterable quantity, which I read, and that to doubt the divine rightness of these principles is treason and sacrilege, which I read, When the greatest thinkers of a race are incapable or afraid to perform their manifest and logical function, it is scarcely to be wondered that the average citizens are also somewhat unwilling to risk life, fortune, and sacred honor for the overthrow of popularized right and wrong concepts that they know from bitter personal experience are unworkable fallacies. Although the average man feels in his heart that nearly all political and religious conventions are dynamic deceits, yet how cautiously he avoids any open display of antagonism thereto. He has not the courage of his opinions. He is afraid to say openly what he thinks secretly. In other words, he's living in a state of subjectiveness, of vassalage. He allows his brain to be dominated and held in bondage by the brain of another. From his infancy, he has been deliberately subjected to a continuous external pressure, especially designed to coerce his understanding into strict accord with prearranged views of moral, political, or religious duty. And I might say, it's all a bunch of words. He has not been permitted one moment of real mental liberty. He imbibed fraudulent conventionalisms with his mother's milk. He listens to the most hideous falsehoods sung in the swelling chorus. He hears them sounded by bugles in silver and brass. He hears them intoned by congregations of the faithful amid peals of sacred music and the solemn roll of the chanted prayer. Thus his mind is sterilized by authority before it has had a chance to mature. Thus youth is mentally castrated, that its natural vitality may be afterwards used up in the yoke of custom, which is the yoke of slavery. In the nursery, at school, and at college, plastic brain pulp is deliberately forced into the prearranged mold. Everything that a corrupt civilization can do is done to compress the growing intellect into unnatural channels. Thus, the great mass of men who inhabit the world of today have no initiative, no originality, or independence of thought, but are mere subjective individualities who have never had the slightest voice in fashioning the ideals that they formerly revere. They just follow the leader. Although the average man has taken no part in manufacturing moral codes and statute laws, yet he obeys them with dog-like submissiveness. He's trained to obedience like oxen are broken to the yoke of their masters. He is born thrall, habituated from childhood to be governed by others. In other words, a slave. Chinese civilization deliberately distorts its children's feet by swathing them in bandages of silk and hoop iron. Christian civilization crushes and cramps the minds of its youth by the means of false philosophies, artificial moral codes, and ironclad political creeds. Hold it. Deleterious sub-theories of good and evil are systematically injected into our natural literatures, and gradually, without serious obstruction, they crystallize themselves into cast-iron formulas, infallible constitutions, will-o'-the-wisp evangels, and other deadly epidemics. Modern leaders of thought are almost wholly wanting in originality and courage. Their wisdom is foolishness, their remedies poison. They idiotically claim that they guide the destinies of nations, whereas in reality they are but the flotsam and scum froth that glides smoothly down the dark stream of decadence. Thus all people of the earth are helpless, seeing those that lead are blind. Mankind is weary of its sham prophets, its demagogues, and its statesmen. It cries out for kings and heroes. It demands nobility, a nobility that cannot be hired with money, like slaves or beasts of burden. The world awaits the coming of mighty men of valor, great destroyers, destroyers of all that is vile, angels of death. We are sick unto nausea of the good Lord Jesus, terror-stricken under the executive of priest, mob, proconsul. We're tired to death of equality. Gods are at a discount. Devils are in command. Demand. He who would rule the coming age must be hard, cruel, and deliberately interpret. For softness assails not successfully the idols of the multitude. Those idols must be smashed into fragments, burnt into ashes, and that cannot be done by the gospel of love. The living forces of evil are to be found in the living ideals of today. The commandments and laws and moral codes that we are called upon to reverence and obey are themselves the insidious engineering of decadence. It is more the moral principles that manufacture beggars. It is golden rules that glorify meekness. It is statute laws that makes dogs of men. A man may keep every one of the Ten Commandments and yet remain a fool all the day of his life. He may obey every written law of the land and yet be a slave. He may love Jesus, delight in the golden rule, and yet continue to the hour of his death a failure and dependent. Truly, the way to hell is by fulfilling the commandments of God. If the all-conquering race to which we belong is not to irretrievably dwindle into multitudinous nothingness like the inferior herds it has outdistanced or enslaved, color them black, then it essentially that the Semitic spider webs so astutely woven for ages into the brains of our chiefs be remorsefully torn out by the very roots, even though the tearing out process be both painful and bloody. If we would retain and defend our inherited manhood, we must not permit ourselves to be forever rocked to repose with the sweet lullabies of Eastern idealisms. Too long have we been hypnotized by the occult charm of a Hebrew utopianist. If we continue to obey the insidious spell that has been laid upon us, we will wake up some dread morning with the gates of hell upon earth, yawning wide open, to close again upon us forever. The idea of hell is in some respects a truthful conception, suggestive of actual fact. If we terrestrialize the location, there is nothing inharmonious about it. Many a race, many a tribe, and many a mighty empire has gone down into the grimly realistic Sheol. Is it not right and just that the vile, the base, the degenerate, that is to say, the slave nations of the earth, should be punished pitilessly for their creeping cowardice? Is it not right that they should be, as it were, fried and toasted, should swim in pools of boiling blood or dance sweltering satanic glees with blistered feet and strained eyeballs on red-hot Saharas of grave and sand? In actual operation, nature is cruel and merciless to men, as to all other beings. Let a tribe of human animals live a rational life. Nature will smile upon them and their posterity. But let them attempt to organize an unnatural mode of existence, an equality, Elysium, and they will be punished even to the point of extermination. That's it for today, 14:05, and I'll be back with you on Moon's Day, 14:05.
To be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart. Somebody twice as smart as I. But somebody who swear to be true as you used to do with me. Who'll leave you to learn that misery loves company? Wait and see. I mean, I wanna be around to see how he does it when he breaks your heart to bits. Let's see if the puzzle fits so fine. That's when I'll discover that revenge is sweet. As I sit there applauding from a front row seat, when somebody breaks your heart like you, like you.
Sorry, boys and girls, I had a request here from one of our loyal associates, from Leanne Rimes, so I'm going to play it for you before we go.
What kind of life?